I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include The French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. He is the author of 4 cookbooks, including The French Laundry Cookbook. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
It took you quite a few years before you bought the French Laundry and your career really took off. You held various cooking positions in Florida, Rhode Island, Catskill in upstate New York. You apprenticed in France. You then went from your first restaurant called Raquel in New York City to another restaurant in Los Angeles. And finally, you landed in Yountville in the Napa Valley. How did you find the French Laundry?
I was in Los Angeles at the time. I was dating a woman who was a wine broker in Los Angeles. Of course, many of her wineries were in Napa Valley. So I would travel with her to Napa Valley probably twice a month. And at that time, there was a chef, colleague, friend from New York City, Jonathan Waxman, who was opening his first restaurant outside of New York in California called Table 29. And during construction, I stopped by to see him one day on one of my trips. He knew I wasn't working. He said, Thomas, there's this restaurant in Yountville called The French Laundry, and I know it's for sale, and I think it'd be perfect for you. And so that was really the catalyst that started the process. And I went to Yountville. I walked on the property of The French Laundry and just emotionally resonated with me. I felt like this was the place.
By the way, this girlfriend, the wine broker, is this the woman whom you started an olive oil company with called Evo in 1992?
Exactly. Yeah, Diane Harder. Exactly. Yeah. Diane and I started an olive oil company called Evo. It was a time when I wasn't working and I was trying to find other avenues from a culinary point of view where I could have an impact.
There's a quote in the French Laundry cookbook which resonated with me. When you first discovered the French Laundry, you said, I gave the French Laundry a new life, and it gave me a new life. And that implies a level of sadness prior to the French Laundry. Was there sadness in your life or restlessness prior to that?
Well, there was certainly a great sense of uncertainty in my life. New York, when I was in New York at Raquel, you know, this city was my home. It was the center of the universe. I never thought I would ever leave New York City. I was emotionally and physically committed to Raquel. And of course, when that failed, I was set adrift, didn't really know what to do. I spent a year in New York trying to find some connection to something, really didn't, and ended up in LA. I went out there to be the chef at Checkers Hotel. A great hotel, we got great exposure. It was a great success, but ultimately, that was a failure for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was set adrift again in LA, and I didn't really know what I was going to do. Was I destined to be a chef? Was I cut out to be a chef? As much as I love cooking, as much as I love the fact of nurturing people through food. So the French Laundry was kind of my last effort. Mm-hmm. If that didn't work, I'm not sure what I would have done.
Why do you think Raquel didn't work out?
There's a number of different things. Certainly, you know, at that time in New York, which was the mid-80s, I mean, it was just booming. Americans were learning about French cuisine, about fine dining, and certainly Raquel was a version of that at that moment. Raquel was downtown in a new area, Hudson Square. My partner, Serge Raoul, who owns Raoul's, certainly had great experience in New York and certainly great experience downtown. I had just come back from France, learning about French food, living there, learning really in the detail of French food. And it was a great success for the first 4 years. I mean, the restaurant was 6 years old by the time we closed it. And then, of course, the area didn't develop as that was predicted to develop. We had certainly the stock market downturn. But I think one of the big reasons is I really didn't understand how to run a restaurant. And from that moment on, I knew that if I was going to have another restaurant, if I was going to be lucky enough to have another restaurant in my life, I needed to have individuals involved in that restaurant that knew more than I did about finance, knew more than I did about running a dining room. I was a chef, and a lot of chefs think they can do everything. I realized at that moment at Raquel, at great expense, personal expense, financial expense, that I didn't know everything I needed to know.
I've heard you say that one of the appeals to cooking is the immediate gratification that you get. But looking at your history, it seems like your life has been more of one of a patient gardener, gardener who has to tolerate the erratic nature of the weather and other components out of one's control. What is your temperament?
It's interesting when you say patience. I learned patience relatively later in life, and a big part of that came to me when I was trying to put together the financial structure for the French Laundry and buying the French Laundry. I would call my attorney every day and ask him if there was any news. And finally, one day he said, "Thomas, listen, I'll call you when there's news." And I had to keep myself busy, and I had to learn to be patient. And then, of course, persistence. I mean, I sit here today as a true example of somebody who was persistent.
You talk about patience in the kitchen, and in your cookbook, the French Laundry cookbook, you talk about being mindful about cutting an artichoke. What are some other examples of your being mindful of the mundane in the kitchen?
Cooking is repetition, and I think that as cooks, you have to be comfortable with knowing that you're going to be doing the same thing your entire career. And of course, that's going to change and evolve, but at the basis of what you're doing, you're cooking, whether it's sautéing or braising or roasting or chopping or slicing or dicing, plating food. I mean, all the poaching, even the new sous vide technology that we're using in the kitchen, all those, once you've mastered them, once you've learned them, you're going to be doing them. They're part of the daily routine. They're part of your daily structure. Repetition, in many ways, liberates you to be working on other things. I mean, I've cleaned salmon so many times before that I don't really have to focus on cleaning the salmon. It's almost like muscle memory, and I can be thinking about more other things, like, what am I going to do with the salmon when I get it cleaned?
Have you been influenced by any religion that has helped you be more mindful? Because you're talking as somebody who might do yoga or meditation, or even, you know, Judaism is about the present. So there's a lot of religious, spiritual components to what you're talking about.
People have said that to me before. Other than as a young boy, I went to Catholic school, and one of the things I did every day was be an altar boy at Mass, and that was something 7 a.m. Mass. I was there, you know, 5 days a week or 6 days a week, because then it was also Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really have much later in life. I didn't have a strong connection to religion, and certainly meditation or any kind of spiritual enlightenment is not part of my. Never been part of my life, really. So sure. I'm not sure where it comes from.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He's the first American chef to be awarded 3 Michelin stars for both of his fine dining restaurants, the French Laundry in Napa Valley, California, and Per Se in New York City. You spent your early life in California before moving to Florida. Your parents were divorced. Your father was a Marine drill instructor, and he left your mother when you were 5 or 6 years old with you and your 4 brothers.
Correct.
What influence did your father's absence in your life have on you?
My mother and father didn't have a very good separation, so they didn't part on friendly terms. So, you know, growing up, and I was 4 years old when they separated, so my whole life was with my mother and my brothers. Mm-hmm. My father wasn't really part of it. He was somebody who lived in Pennsylvania. I don't want to say I didn't have any need for him, but I didn't have an apparent need for him. I certainly had those father figures in my older brothers. They were my role models. They were my teachers, you know, from a masculine point of view. And my mother was there. My mother was an amazing person, very dedicated, committed to her children and their well-being. And she ran restaurants. So she was gone in many evenings, which left the older brothers, my older brothers, to kind of cook for us and babysit us, which was fine. But I didn't grow up on, you know, sitting on my mother's knees during the polenta or my grandmother's, you know, in my grandmother's kitchen, you know, baking biscuits. But as I started to grow older, I spent more and more time at the restaurant. And I really enjoyed those moments in my mother's restaurant, in those kitchens.
When you say your mother's restaurant, she was a restaurant manager of an existing restaurant
exactly.
in Florida.
She didn't own the restaurant. She ran the restaurants, yes.
What are some of those early memories that you have with her in the restaurant?
Well, you know, the restaurants are very nurturing places. And at the same time, kitchens can be very violent places. Mm-hmm. So you have this real dichotomy between these two environments. You have these individuals in there who are continuously cooking for people and nurturing them. But at the same time, you have sharp knives, you have wet floors, you have steam, you have heat, you have all these different things going on. So you really have to be aware in a kitchen. And I think awareness was key for me. And I think that was one of the great things I learned early on from my mother and being in those kitchens was a sense of awareness of everything that's around me and being careful.
Hmm. When you were with your mother in those earlier years, did you have thoughts of, you know, this is where I want to make my life? When did that come to mature?
Well, I never thought about being a chef in those early days. When I did venture out on my own and have a job in the real world, which was in construction, my older brothers were in construction, so I kind of migrated towards that. But once I found my way back into the kitchen, and although I didn't realize it at that time, looking back at that moment, washing dishes at the Palm Beach Yacht Club really prepared me to be a cook, because the actions that you are doing as a dishwasher, the same things that you're going to be doing as a cook. In other words, it's about organization. So as all the dirty dishes and silverware and glasses come in, you have to be extremely organized. You have to have them stacked correctly. You have to have them piled. You have to have the water ready for the silverware. You have to be efficient. So you have to be able to stack the plates up correctly or get the silverware done correctly so that you're efficient in your movement, so you're not wasting any time. You get instant feedback. You know, if you don't scrape the dishes correctly or spray them down correctly before they go in the dish machine, they come out dirty. Mm-hmm. And then you learn to be part of a team. Everybody in the restaurant relies on you. So those were four critical elements of being a really good dishwasher that you translate to being a really good cook.
Yeah. It was washing dishes that helped you realize, you know what, I can make a life in the kitchen. But you had a level of organization and almost compulsiveness for cleanliness and precision, even outside the kitchen, in your home growing up. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what you were like in your own home?
Well, my mother was meticulous. I mean, the house had to be clean all the time. And you take your shoes off before you went inside, you know, I mean, at one point, I remember in my life, the furniture was covered in plastic wrap, you know, to protect the fabric. We all had chores every week. My brothers and I always had chores. And Joseph and I, being the youngest, would always have to do the chores of the oldest. I was the one that always had to clean the bathroom, and that was probably the most difficult and certainly the most... You really became aware of how clean it was.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. We'll hear more from Thomas coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include the French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. You weren't surrounded by, you know, this rich culinary life growing up in any way. How did that transition occur from, you know, washing dishes in a, you know, random restaurant with your mom to actually acquiring this awareness of this whole other culinary world?
So if you think back at the Palm Beach Yacht Club, I was washing dishes. And one day my mother came to me and said, you know, Richard, who was the chef at the time, you know, Richard's going to leave in a couple weeks. So, you know, if you watch what he does, we're going to make you the chef.
How old were you?
I was probably 19.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, this is interesting. But I did have a leg up. My brother Joseph was already in the profession. He had decided at a relatively young age, 12 or 13, that he really wanted to be a chef. And Richard did show me. He showed me how to make an omelet. He showed me how to, you know, grill a flank steak, make hamburgers, things like that. And that's really what basically it was. The most difficult thing I had to do every day was make a hollandaise sauce. And my brother Joseph was very influential in helping me do that.
But no formal training ever.
No formal training. But there was really not an option. There wasn't a lot of options back in 1974 for formal training. Cooking wasn't viewed as it is today. There was really not a whole lot of interest in becoming a chef.
You had the reputation of managing your kitchen as if you were a military marine drill instructor like your father, and it's almost trite to ask, mm-hmm. you know, what parallels are there between you and your father, but how has that occurred to you?
Well, you're right. I mean, absolutely. There is a definite hierarchy in the kitchen. That hierarchy was defined by Augustus Escoffier in the turn of the 1900s.
Is this the brigade system?
The brigade system. Yeah. So you have a brigade or brigade. I mean, brigade in French, brigade in America. And, I mean, there is you know, the hierarchy. There's the chef who's the leader. Then there's the sous chefs, demi sous chefs, chef de parties, commis. So you have this real hierarchy of how the kitchen operates. And when you think about a kitchen, especially during service or most of the time, it's about command response. And when you think about it, that initial command really comes from the guest. Mm-hmm. You sit down at the table, you look at the menu, and you choose what you want to eat. And you tell the waiter. And that's your command. Then all of a sudden, as the chef, then you tell all the chef de parties what needs to be done. And they respond. So from a militaristic point of view, it's the same in the military. It's all about command response.
Was it striking to you that, my career is paralleling my father's to a large degree?
It was a little bit. I didn't really think about it until much later in life. Much later in life, my early 20s, when I really started to think about it, and I started to reach out to my father to reconnect with my father at that time in my life.
And when you did reach out to him, you really reconnected in a big way. Your father moved from Pennsylvania to California to be with you at the French Laundry.
Yes.
In Napa Valley. And he died after having a car accident about a year after?
About a year and a half after he arrived in Yountville. He had a horrific car accident that left him a quadriplegic. And that was one of the most challenging moments of my life is to prepare him to come home, his home in Yountville.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. He was awarded France's highest culinary decoration, the Légion d'Honneur, for popularizing French cuisine in America in 2011. So you found your home in the French Laundry, and it took you about 2 years to raise $1.5 million to get the restaurant off the ground. Who did you raise the capital from?
Yeah, it was $1.2 million. But I mean, back then that was, you know, I mean, when you don't have any money, you know, a substantial amount of money was an enormous amount of money to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went through three different avenues to raise the money. One was a commercial bank loan, real estate loan. Although I realized that once I started to apply for the bank loans, the failure here in New York City came to be a problem. So I had to have my old partner Serge Raoul, who really went out on a limb for me financially, come back and satisfy some of the debt that was still outstanding at Raquel. Mm. So, you know, when you think about the people that are involved in your life and how they come to your aid in some of the most unpredictable ways. I mean, certainly we had a failed restaurant. We had parted ways. I was gone for 3.5 years, and all of a sudden I need him to come back and satisfy a financial debt for us. And so, you know, that was one of the first individuals that, you know, really stepped up to the plate to help. The second part was a small business administrative loan. And we were very fortunate that I was very fortunate at that time. President Clinton had just come into office. He was trying to re-energize the economy. So he funded the SBA in a significant way. And, you know, a white middle class educated male was not the profile for the SBA prior to that. And then finally, the last component was going out to private individuals for private placement. And I reached out to probably over 400 people. And that was probably the most difficult part of my life, trying to sell this project. And out of 400, we had 50 people who finally signed a check. And that was the final straw that helped me buy the French Laundry.
And the French Laundry in the 1880s, when it was first built, was actually a bar.
Before Prohibition, it was opened as a saloon gambling brothel. Yountville, in that time, we have a veterans home there, which is the oldest veterans home in America, or in California, I'm sorry. And then what happened really is that the state really got tired of all the problems they were having in Yountville, so they passed a law that there wasn't a lot of alcohol served within 2 miles of the veterans home. So that shut down Yountville. And that's when a young French couple, bought the property. Yountville, Napa Valley at that time still was a place that many of the social elite from San Francisco would summer in. So their business model was to, you know, service all of these the socialites in their homes with the laundry service, and hence that was where the French Laundry began.
After 10 years of French Laundry, you opened Per Se in 2004 in New York City. So you returned to the city that rejected you in the earliest days. How did that relationship with the Time Warner Center originate?
Time Warner Center was being developed by the Related Group. At that time, they were really looking towards France to come and occupy and build the restaurants there. At the same time, one or two of the French chefs that just arrived in America received some less than flattering reviews. So they kind of repositioned themselves and said, okay, let's not go to France. Let's look into America. And they reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in being one of their tenants. And I'd looked at New York once in a while, you know, mm-hmm. through the history of the French Laundry. You know, people would always say, when are you coming home? You know, home being New York City. If I was going to do another restaurant, another fine dining restaurant, there's really no other city in America to do it. And the Time Warner Center really offered us an opportunity to do it in a significant way.
You had a charmed life with French Laundry, but Per Se had an inauspicious start. There was a fire which mm-hmm. set you back. Can you talk to me about
the
that
fire.
Episode?
We opened the restaurant on February 19th in 2004, a little less than 10 years after we opened the French Laundry. And we had closed the French Laundry and brought 30 of those individuals to Per Se to help inoculate and train the new team. So we were off to a great start. And then on that, the 26th of February, it was right at staff meal. And I was in the butcher room with two of my sous chefs and we were chatting. And we started to smell smoke. Then we started to see smoke. And that's when I evacuated the kitchen, the restaurant. We called the fire department. And that was basically what I thought was the beginning of end. And I stood there when that young fireman, you know, standing on top of the tables and just taking that big axe and going through the wall and the flame shooting out and water pouring out everywhere. And I thought, you know, I called my attorney and I said, I got to get out of here. But the next day we came back and, you know, we had a whole different attitude. We're going to now have a second chance to open this restaurant. And then I started getting cards from our Asian guests, and they were all flowers were coming and congratulations were coming because in Asia, if you have a fire in your kitchen, it means you're going to be successful. So it's just, you know, it was a matter of point of view.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. I want to talk about just the experience of dining in the French Laundry or Per Se. The menus change every day in both restaurants, and you've said that you don't repeat any ingredients in the 9 courses. Is that true?
We repeat luxury ingredients. So there may be truffles twice, or there may be foie gras twice, but we would never have mushrooms twice, or carrots twice, or turnips twice, or things like that.
Do you think the clientele would really mind?
Well, you know, at some point, you know, as much as we appreciate and work for our guests, it's really about us. You know, it's about our values and our standards and challenging ourselves. And it was really a challenge in the beginning. Okay, we're not going to repeat any garnishes, any vegetables. Why would we? We're the French Laundry.
And we're going to have a new menu every day.
Right.
Can you walk me through some of the items on your menus that you are particularly fond of?
Some of the signature dishes or some of the iconic dishes anyway, certainly the coronet of salmon. And what that is, it really looks like a miniature ice cream cone. And the inspiration from that ice cream cone, for that dish came from my experience eating ice cream cones.
At Baskin and Robbins.
Here in Chinatown, exactly. And that's where, when you think about awareness, how important awareness is, because you can look at something every day or every week or experience something over and over again and never really realize the full potential of what that is. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until that day in 1991 when I was at Baskin Robbins and the ice cream cone was put in front of me, did I see the coronet.
How about the oysters and pearls, which is another iconic offering of yours?
Exactly. It's one of those iconic dishes that is prepared every day. It was a purple box. And I was walking down the aisle of a grocery store and I saw a purple box. And on the purple box, it said, you know, pearl tapioca. And I'm thinking, where do pearls come from? Pearls come from oysters. And therefore, you know, I bought a box of pearl tapioca, took it back to the French Laundry, and knew exactly what I was going to do with it. And there we have oysters and pearls.
And there is a level of playfulness on the menu at Per Se, mm-hmm. which seems surprising perhaps to people who go because, oh, this is a fine dining establishment and they might expect it to be stuffier than it certainly is.
if you've experienced macaroni and cheese before, I think, which we all have, we can reinterpret that in a way that's going to be significant, and you're going to go, wow, that's just like the best macaroni and cheese I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Coffee and donuts, is another one of those iconic dishes. And when you think about, yes, fine dining restaurants historically have always been intimidating, and it's something that I don't want to represent in our restaurants. And so when you get that cornet, I mean, you have to smile. It's just so darn cute.
The law of diminishing marginal returns is important to you, and the idea is when you are giving people their food, you give them just enough to keep it interesting before they move on to the next.
Exactly. And you think about the law of diminishing returns, and something came evident to me when I was a young person living in Florida, and we would go to the beach on Saturday and have beer. And at first, cold beer on a hot summer day was really amazing, really refreshing, really good. And of course, by the time the second one came around, it was less, and the third one was even less so. I translated that into the way I thought about food.
There's a comedian, Louis C.K. He says, some people might eat until they're full and then move and then stop, but I eat until I'm ashamed. What are your own eating habits?
I try to eat healthy, of course. I don't try to eat a lot of food. I try, in the morning, it's very ritualistic. Typically, I'll have some type of granola with chia seeds and some ground flaxseed, which I grind myself. Then I'll have my vitamin regimen with some juice or some probiotics, and then I'll have coffee. And then throughout the day, I typically eat with the team at the restaurant. I'm eating at 8 a.m. in the morning, at noon, and then again at 4:45, because that's when we serve our p.m. meal. So if I stay on that schedule, I feel really, really good.
I want to talk about your suppliers. You have more than 350 suppliers for the restaurant?
For the restaurant, yeah. Suppliers come and go depending on the season, depending on what they're growing, depending on where they are.
Can you provide some examples of your suppliers, some of the stories of your suppliers?
There are so many. Ingrid Benjes, who's in Stonington, Maine, who is accidental. I mean, she was an author. She moved to Maine, and she was trying to make a living. And she found some mushrooms and found a home for them at Balducci's here in New York. And they said, well, what else do you have? And she said, well, I'm from Maine. Maybe I can get you lobsters. And so that was almost 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. Diane St. Clair in Orwell, Vermont. She gets up every day, 7 days a week at 4 a.m. to milk the cows by 6 so that she can start making the butter, that she cultured the day before, make 20 pounds of butter a day.
Incidentally, I have to mention, I was reading New York Magazine recently, and there's this this piece on Per Se talking about, that trysts happen. You're working intensely with people, and you become intimate with them. That is true for you, too.
It is.
You hired Laura Cunningham, who was your restaurant manager, really.
Correct.
Your first hire, mm-hmm. at the French Laundry, and she's now your partner.
Exactly.
Can you describe that evolution?
Well, it's interesting. In we work so hard and so long, so many hours, and you're right. You really become intimate with the individuals that you're working with, in so many ways, and it's always kind of difficult when you begin a personal relationship with a coworker, mm-hmm. but no more so than with Laura and I. Because at the French Laundry, when we were both working at the French Laundry, every day together, we lived next door. It really became a true family kind of environment. I mean, if mother wouldn't let you do something, let's go ask father.
You have this reputation for being really very control-oriented. And in fact, you said a kitchen is about control at any level. But do you think you're any different from the top chefs? There's this element of
control.
Yeah,
we're control freaks. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, chefs, historically, I mean, by nature, are control freaks. They want to control. They need to control what's going on in their kitchen so that they're controlling what's going on in the dining room. We talk about emotional chefs. Chefs that have outbursts and get upset, and where that comes from. I mean, the genesis of that is something happening that prevents me from giving you, the guest, the experience that I want. Because if something comes in the way of that, something clogs that, then there's a problem.
Have you in the past, like, worried, oh, you know, I'm not going to be very well liked if I'm going to be so control oriented? Like, did you ever have to kind of grapple with that for yourself?
Yeah, you do. I mean, when I was younger, I mean, those emotions, those emotional outbursts, you know, sometimes became personal, and you realize that that's not the way to operate. That's not respectful, and you ended up going back to the person that you had that emotional outburst, and you had to apologize to that person.
What's an example? We talk at 30,000 feet of, you know, your attention to detail and your control orientation. What's an example of that in the kitchen day to day?
Everything's about precision.
But what's an example?
Okay, an example is, let's take something as simple as knife skills. You know, cutting brunoise of vegetables. Brunoise of vegetables is something that's 1/8 of an inch square. Mm-hmm. You know, and being able to make sure that the mandoline that you have that slices the elongated piece of vegetable is really, really sharp and has the right calibration in terms of thickness. And then that your knife skills, because then your knife skills come, because then you're slicing that long, thin julienne of vegetable into a brunoise. Let's talk about quenelling.
Quenelling is
having two spoons. And quenelling is something that we do in so many different ways. It's making something in the shape of an egg.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a quenelle is something that's the shape of an egg. If you're quenelling sorbet or ice cream, you know, it really requires the sorbet or the ice cream to be a specific temperature. And it requires you to have a spoon that's clean and hot, so that when you move your spoon through the ice cream or sorbet, the sorbet just folds over itself and forms this perfect egg-shaped quenelle of ice cream. Or if you're using two spoons, when we're quenelling the caviar for the oyster and pearl, for example, making sure that you have enough caviar on the spoon and your spoons are clean and accurate, so that, and your movement back and forth to create this shape that you're then going to put on the dish, which is oysters and pearls, which is the first dish that our guests really receive, and something that's so impactful for them.
Do you have the same level of precision in your personal life?
Habits are really important. So I think it's important that you recognize a certain standard. And many of us, let's take a T-shirt, for example. You may have a little hole in your T-shirt, and nobody really sees it. So is it to your standard to know that you're wearing a T-shirt that has a hole in it? Or is your standard so that you know there's a hole in it and it's not acceptable even to you, even though no one else sees it, and you get a new T-shirt?
And what is your standard?
New T-shirt.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been the chef Thomas Keller. Coming up, we'll meet Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes through the New York metro region, Long Island, and Los Angeles. Elizabeth and Julie opened their first studio in 2006 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the company has grown rapidly in popularity, attracting clients like Chelsea Clinton, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and Kelly Ripa. SoulCycle classes are 45 minutes long and claim to be a full body workout. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. For having us.
So you are both unlikely people to start an exercise company. Tell me a little bit about your background. Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth?
I grew up in Chicago. I was not one of those kids who was really into sports. And I lived in Colorado for 14 years. And when I was living in Colorado, I got into hiking in particular, which is a great form of cardio. And when I moved back to New York, I met my husband, and I did yoga also. And I continued to do that. And after our children were born, I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And my mother, who I adore, told me, oh, you know, don't worry about what you eat. I wore my jeans home from the hospital. And sadly enough, that was not my experience whatsoever. And about 6 weeks after our first daughter was born, I still had 45 pounds to go. And one of my dearest friends just said to me, you have got to get some cardio. And I was so intimidated. I was afraid. And I went to take a class. And a light really went off for me. I really felt like if I could access this, then so many people who feel like they can't do cardio could access this, and it could really change something for them, because everybody needs cardio and most people hate it.
Now, this was an indoor cycling class. Can you explain what a spin class or an indoor cycling class is for those who have never taken one?
At SoulCycle, we ride on indoor cycling bikes, and we have pedals that people use specific bike shoes to clip into. And what's great about that is that you're using your entire leg. But so basically what it is it's riding inside on a stationary bike in a class that's set to music and led by a teacher.
Elizabeth, you sold real estate in Colorado when you were living there.
I was. I had grown up in a real estate family. My mother was a very successful real estate broker in Chicago, and ended up moving to Telluride. And while I was there, I got introduced to an arm of Oriental medicine called Jinshin Jitsu. So because of the lifestyle that exists in Colorado, I was able to do both, but just wasn't really the money that I would need to sort of live my life.
So you moved to New York City and you discovered indoor cycling. At what point did you say, you know what, this would be an interesting business to start?
You know, my sister-in-law owns Bikram Yoga, is a co-owner of Bikram Yoga here in the city. And so she was, I said to her, you know, I'm feeling this urge to do this. I mean, I had a five-month-old and a three-year-old. And she was really encouraging.
And how about you, Julie? You were a talent manager in Los Angeles.
I was in L.A. for about 9 years. And not unlike Elizabeth, I sort of had, you know, an aha moment on a bike. I've always been sort of athletic, but it's never really had a joyful effect on me before. I thought to myself, I get it. I understand why this can be something that's not just, you know, checking off, you know, exercise today on my to-do list.
What's an example of the impact that SoulCycle has had, not necessarily just physically?
Our experience now over and over again is people coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't go to my therapist anymore because I do it on the bike. Or I literally walked into the Upper East Side studio the other day and a woman came up to me and she said, I want you to know that you saved my life. She said, I just had a baby and I started working out here right after, you know, my child was born and you really saved my life. And I said to her, I'm so glad to hear it. You look amazing. How, you know, how old is your child? And she said, oh, my baby is 5 months old, but that's not at all what I'm talking about. She explained that it really helped her connect to her child and back to herself and to her family. For us, the surprise gift in this business has been the emotional release that it has given to people.
When you noticed the benefits of doing a spin class, why did you necessarily say, I'd like to start a business? Where did that come from?
Truth be told, I sort of looked high and low for an experience that would make me feel like what I had found in my, you know, little indoor cycling studio in Los Angeles. I tried every indoor cycling class in New York City, and I just could not find it.
Was there also some unhappiness with your current work environment that kind of gave you the extra push to say, you know what, I'd like something new?
Definitely. Well, one thing that Elizabeth and I have very much in common were we both started the business when we had babies that were 5 months old. After I had my daughter, I definitely was feeling like I would like to figure out a job where I could work on my own terms.
So you both had this idea in isolation. How did you ultimately meet each other?
We met at a lunch. We were introduced and we started to talk.
By a mutual friend.
Yes. And slowly but surely, we started to talk about the ideas that we had for creating an indoor cycling business. I like this about this place, but I think this could be better. Or wouldn't it be great if you could do some upper body work in the 45 minutes? Or could you imagine if
we had a reservation system?
Right. Or it was a, you know, a chic environment. Mm-hmm. Or all the teachers spoke the same language, so you didn't go to, you know, Joe's class at 10 in the morning and it was boot camp, and,
right,
you know,
what
Bill's
was
class at 10 o'clock in the evening and it was, you know, Zen cycle. We always say it was the best blind date we ever went on.
Have you looked at some studies that show the benefits of group exercise versus exercising on your own, for example?
If you drew a chart, you would probably see that the workout for a group of people is more consistent than one person working out by themselves. If you are out there on the West Side Highway running by yourself, on a low day you might run a little slower, and on a fast day you might run a little faster, but probably you are working at a pretty hard level if you are in a class at SoulCycle, because the group is going to carry you with them.
Incidentally, indoor cycling classes take place in the dark. Where did that come from?
For us, we do ride in candlelight, and it sort of sets the tone of a respectful room, a place where people you know, are there for the right reasons. We have this site on our page on our site called Soul Etiquette, which is just about, you know, how we treat each other. I mean, we really treat it as a sanctuary.
I noticed the music plays such a prominent role. Can you talk to a little bit about the music and really, you know, there's a DJ component to it.
Absolutely. Our instructors spend a lot of time creating their playlists. You know, there's a musical arc that follows the emotional arc, that follows the physical arc.
We have a place on the site where we put our 10 favorite songs of the month. We went through a real phase, and I think it's a classic. We'll always love the Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind.
It's Alicia Keys and Jay-Z.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a group of indoor cycling studios in New York City, the Hamptons, and Los Angeles. So I want to switch to the nuts and bolts of how you started your business. So you had this excellent first date where you said, okay, I want to get started. So what were the first steps that you took?
Elizabeth started looking for spaces.
We were combing Manhattan. We weren't coming up with much. I mean, people don't really want to rent to, especially at that time in 2006, to people who have no track record whatsoever. So we managed to find a sublet in the back of a lobby on 72nd Street, great located, very well located, on Craigslist. And we thought there was going to be a sign. And then just as we went to go sign the lease, they said, oh, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a sign and you're never going to have one. Mm. And if you would like to have one, it will be inside the lobby on your door. So we did a lot of guerrilla marketing. We got a rickshaw, which we painted. We painted it silver and yellow, which are two colors that we use. And we parked it out in front of the studio and locked it up, hoping that it wouldn't get stolen or ticketed. And we'd say, oh, should we spend another $65 on the ticket for this night so that people know where we are?
Well, we literally used to get a ticket every day from the community board for parking our rickshaw outside. And we parked out there for a long time until finally
stolen.
The community board wanted to actually see us.
Right. And then it got stolen. It was sort of a happy accident.
And how long did it take you from your first meeting to opening the doors on the first day?
4 months.
Yeah.
Quick.
Quick. After our first meeting, Elizabeth started looking for space immediately. And, you know, we didn't even know each other very well. So I was still working at my full-time job. And we would sort of talk in the morning and make our separate to-do lists. And I would schedule my lunch break. So, you know, I was representing models at the time. And, you know, I would sort of be creating shampoo deals and stuff. And then during lunch, I would meet the towel guy downstairs. We really just sat down and made a list. Things you need for cycling: water, bikes, shoes, a space. Elizabeth went to IKEA and created most of our first studio out of IKEA cabinetry. Our front desk and our original studio is from good old IKEA.
And Elizabeth, you were also an investor in the beverage company Izzy, which was ultimately sold to Pepsi. How did you come to be one of the early investors in Izzy?
My best friend from college and her husband, who I grew up down the street from, happened to get married, and they started this company after their first daughter was born. We had seen it in Colorado, and, you know, I said to my husband, I said, well, I think we should put some money in it, and I called Todd, and he said, I cannot take your money. I'm going to lose it. I really cannot do this. And I said, okay, I completely understand, but I'm an adult, and if you change your mind, let me know. And 2 days later, he called, and he said, we just got a huge order from Whole Foods. It's our first big order, and we have no money to fill the order, so we will be glad to take your check. And then it was really just a really amazing, happy coincidence. I mean, we had the money to do what we needed to do. Sort of, it was extremely timely. The business was pretty successful from the beginning, but it just took the pressure off us in terms of, you know, paying back investors.
So were you the sole investor initially for the company?
Yes, I was.
So tell me a little more about the logistics of getting the business off the ground. What are some other kind of surprises that, you know, didn't go the way that you had hoped initially?
We put a lot of time into developing an online reservation system. So we would open the reservation system noon on Mondays. The bikes would open for the week and you could just sign up for the classes that you wanted. And we got to a point in the business where things got, as we started to add classes to the studio, things got really busy. And so the system would crash at noon on Monday, which is like the last thing in the world that you want to happen because you make people so mad. We really had to work through the technology of that.
We didn't know a lot about soundproofing in the beginning. Or how close people live to a building that you're playing music in.
Did you get complaints from neighbors or?
Oh, neighbors, other tenants, landlords. It was one of those. And it was like we threw every expensive Band-Aid on the ceiling that we could.
Well, we had hired a contractor at the behest of our broker who said he knew about soundproofing because he did porn studios in Midtown. And so we thought, well, these people really know what they're doing. And when it came right down to it, that technology did not work at all. We were so horrified because we thought we were doing good.
I will say on a larger scale, you know, we really, when we created this business, we actually created a very atypical model, which I think for us was probably one of the biggest obstacles in the beginning. New York had not really yet adopted the concept of boutique fitness, meaning a pay-per-class model, a pay-per-class cardio model. It's one of those things where you pay your money, you know, on a monthly membership to a gym, and you can take spin class. And so it's always a throw-in, a gimme. So I would say that for the first, you know, 6 months, a year, I mean, it was just a barrage of phone calls all day where you'd pick up the phone and the person on the other end would say, "This is included in my membership. Why would I pay you for something that I already get for free?" They were sort of outraged, actually.
You should tell that story about your father.
Oh, well, I remember showing my dad the first studio, and he walked in and he looked around and he looked for the showers and he couldn't find them. And he came a couple months after we'd been open and he looked at me and he said, "People really come here?" And I said, "Yeah, people really come here and the people that come here really like it." And I could just see him looking at my mother. Desperately afraid that we were not going to be able to send our child to college. The real truth is that they're a room with bikes in them.
And you showed him.
Yeah. Sort of.
He's Dad. Impressed now. He is impressed. It's very sweet to see how proud he is of Julie.
Given that this was, to some extent, a lifestyle change for both of you, given that you both had five-month-olds, did you have ambition to open up more than one studio, or did kind of success just create the inertia to get you to expansion mode?
Well, in the beginning, we thought if we had one great studio, that was...
Or maybe three.
But. That was really... I mean, but we really, you know, we had a certain number of riders and we thought, oh my goodness, if we could get 50 people here every day, this would just be it. Imagine the feeling of the first morning that, you know, we opened the door and there was a full class. I mean, I can vividly remember the feeling of the first person that did not get a bike in a class.
And when did that happen?
I mean, that was maybe three or 4 or 5 months in.
Was there a catalyst? Meaning, what were those turning points, either in people or press, that really helped escalate your success?
Well, it's funny that you say that because when we first opened the studio, I lived across the street. My husband and my daughter and I lived in a tiny rent-controlled apartment that we were busting at the seams growing out of. But on Sundays, I would, you know, sort of, you know, feed Phoebe her bottle and then say, "Oops, got to go put the garbage out. Tomorrow morning, the garbage guys are coming," you know, or maybe they left the candles burning from the last class. I should go check. I mean, it was that kind of a hands-on. We did everything. And I remember that when our first articles would come out, I would say to Elizabeth, "The New York Times is coming out tomorrow. I'm going to get to the studio at 5 a.m. because I can imagine what the phone calls are going to be like," you know, "Beg my husband, can you watch the baby this morning?" And we would sit there. And maybe if we got one or two phone calls the whole day. I mean, it was no more or no less than any other day at SoulCycle in the beginning. We had a perfect storm sort of a little bit into our business, and this is kind of what it was. The viral marketing started to pick up, and people started to come.
And people really brought their friends. I mean, it was like that commercial, the hair commercial.
You know, 80s. I told a friend, and they told two friends,
and so on and so on and so on, and it really was like that.
Then a bunch of press did come out, and then we opened a studio in Bridgehampton. So many people go out to vacation out in the Hamptons in the summer, and we thought it would be a really great way to spread the word. And it was really that fall, after that summer, that our business really started to pop.
And any kind of one celebrity that happened to come in that caused kind of a wave effect?
It was Bill Clinton. We did a fundraiser when Hillary was running for president, and we decided to raise money for Hillary's campaign. And it was
through a rider.
It was through a rider, and she helped us to get President Clinton there.
He didn't ride.
He didn't ride, but he came and he spoke about
healthcare.
And then we did a ride with what we assumed were going to be would have been his favorite songs if he had actually rode the bike. You know what? It was a slow news day. And everyone came. There was nothing else going on in the world except that President Clinton was speaking at SoulCycle. And I remember, and this was great, we called a company that did billboards on Fifth Avenue, and we begged them to stay up all night and make a wrap for the front doors of SoulCycle because we had no sign. And we knew that news crews would be outside wanting to shoot President Clinton going in because nobody could get inside the event. And so we had them create a facade that covered the entire doors so that when you pulled it open, it was a big wheel. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, our logo made it all over the news. It was on Entertainment Tonight, and it was on the New York Times and the Daily News. And it was really a big, big thing for us.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
Nice to be here.
My guests have been Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Let's hear